Thank you, Peter, and thank you, John, for organizing this terrific event. So I'm going to talk about three things. First of all, how far have we moved towards peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis? And secondly, why haven't we been able to achieve peace? And thirdly, what the next president can do about it? So I'm not going to, this is a very well-informed audience, so I'm not going to take you back to the origins of this crisis. But it's just worth remembering briefly how the Zionist dream in 1897 became the Palestinian nightmare in 1948 when Israel was established, and how Palestinians and Arabs resisted, losing even more land in 1967. And how it took until 1988, we're talking 40 years after the State of Israel was created, to accept that there would tragically be no going back to Palestine as it was in 1948, and for the Palestinians to declare a two-state solution as their national goal. So in fact, in spite of the many wars and this continuing, ongoing, bloody conflict, we've traveled a long way towards ending the conflict between the reality of Palestine and the reality of Israel. So why haven't we been able to achieve peace? Put very simply, as the Palestinians moved towards the center, the Israelis moved towards the right. Israel believed it could keep almost all of the land and leave almost none for the Palestinians. Israeli colonization of Palestinian land, as well as Israeli controls of Palestinian movement, continued even during the best years of the peace process. We're talking the good years of the peace process from 1993 on to this day. Still, it's important to note that there was a moment at Taba in January 2001, when an agreement was almost reached that could have been implemented. The Israeli-Palestinian joint statement of 27 January 2001 said they'd never been closer to reaching an agreement and had not only discussed, but made substantial progress on core issues, refugees, security, borders, and Jerusalem. Unfortunately, Ariel Sharon was elected prime minister. And as you know, of all Israeli leaders, he's done most to settle the West Bank and to undermine the Palestinian national movement. To understand the extent of the changes Israel made in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, I would encourage you all to go onto the website of the United Nations at ochaopt.org and take a look at the PowerPoint they've produced on the fragmentation of the West Bank. It's very short, and it superimposes very starkly every single aspect of Israel's occupation infrastructure on a map of the West Bank. And by the end of that visual, after you've seen how the 149 settlements, the settlers, close to now 500,000, the closed military areas, the military bases, the nature reserves, and the separation wall, you'll see how the Palestinian areas look like just slivers of flesh hanging off a skeleton. And that's why many Palestinians, including, and this is important, including the most moderate Palestinian Authority officials, are beginning to call for reframing the struggle as one for equal rights within Israel and Palestine. Today, Palestinians are arguably more powerless than ever before. But Israel is stuck, even though it controls the land and has one of the strongest militaries. And there are four reasons why it's stuck. First of all, the settlement movement has become almost too strong for the Israeli establishment to control. It's now well represented in the army. It's not only attacking Palestinians, the settler movement, but also attacking Israeli soldiers and recently begun to attack Israeli civilians who oppose the occupation. Two, Israel's legal situation is untenable. And just how untenable was reaffirmed by the International Court of Justice in its 2004 advisory opinion on the wall. It said many things. I mean, it affirmed that the occupation is illegal, that the wall is illegal, but it said Israel should cease and dismantle the wall, pay compensation, and warned other states not to support this illegal regime of the wall, which has serious implications for the United States, given its aid to Israel. Third, Israel's moral situation is untenable. Many people, including former President Jimmy Carter and several Israelis, now using the term apartheid to apply to Israel's colonization. Israelis worry about this and have written about it. And the especially dire situation in Gaza has caused, arouses moral outrage, considerable moral outrage. And fourth, the Israelis have successfully weakened the Palestinian leadership. But this is actually very bad news for Israel, because many analysts, among other things, many analysts believe that implementing a two-state solution will require a compromise on the Palestinian right of return. So think about it. If it took the late Yasser Arafat decades to get his people to make a compromise on land, a very painful compromise on land, what will it take to get a compromise on the right of return? I believe that Yasser Arafat was perhaps the only leader who might have been able to persuade the Palestinians to do so. I don't think the current leadership, I think it has been weakened to the extent that it doesn't have the authority to take such a move. So this is what the next U.S. president faces. Can he afford to ignore the Arab-Israeli conflict? No. Many quarters, including the bipartisan Iraq study groups and others, have warned that you can't solve any of the problems of the Middle East without tackling the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Plus, polls of Arabs and Muslims all over the world consistently show that the U.S. policy that they most dislike is unquestioning support for Israel, and this is bad for U.S. security. So what should the U.S. president do? And what shouldn't he do? We're talking about the next president. First, he should de-link, putting an end to Israel's occupation from negotiations about final status. Let's tackle the ending the occupation immediately while we talk about final status. He will need to push Israel to take on the settlement movement and help it to do so, and insist on a freeze and dismantlement of the settlements. He must stop weakening and start strengthening the Palestinian leadership, and there are several moves that need to be done to this effect. One is to bring in Hamas, which has made it very clear that it wants a two-state solution, and it has effectively upheld ceasefires that, by the way, it has negotiated with Israel on several occasions, including right now. Second, there must be an Israeli release of Palestinian prisoners if the Palestinian Authority is going to begin to regain its credibility. And third, there needs to be lifting of Israeli restrictions on Palestinian freedom of movement. Another thing that the U.S. president and the next president should do is to bring in Arab actors to enable compromise and offset the power balance between Palestinians and Israelis, and to protect the Palestinian leadership if it decides to take risks, especially regarding the right of return. Finally, he should bring in international actors to offer protection to the Israelis if they decide to take risks, and also to spread the burden on the U.S. of taking on the Zionist lobby here in the States. What the U.S. president must not do is start a new drawn-out negotiating process or host fancy conferences and meetings. We've been there, we've done that for the last 15 years, so enough of all that. If it's to be a two-state solution, everybody knows what it will look like. And by the way, if it's going to be two states, the only thing that will fly is a fully independent and sovereign Palestine alongside Israel. Most of all, the new president should not fall into the trap of supporting sequenced confidence-building steps, a major reason why the previous agreements were not implemented. We should start with a mutual comprehensive ceasefire so as to neutralize the security excuse, and then move very quickly to dismantle outposts and settlements, release prisoners, and bring freedom of movement and access at the same time as discussions on final status. Can the next president do so? Certainly, as everybody knows, the U.S. has plenty of clout with Israel, given its aid. But, of course, can he afford to do so politically, given the power of the Zionist lobby and of the Christian right? Here, I think there are signs of hope because of changes in the U.S. political and economic map. With the financial crisis, it's much harder to justify aid to Israel, whose GDP per capita is higher than Portugal's, especially given its illegal and immoral actions in the West Bank. Peace would be a lot cheaper. Then there's the growing strength of the Jewish center and left, And that will give the next president a lot more space to, or a lot more room to maneuver if he wants to take it. There's also a growing strength of a number of progressive groups throughout the United States, including the mainstream churches who are beginning to discuss divestment. So to conclude my remarks, the next president's task will be a lot harder, of course, if Benjamin Netanyahu gets elected, given Netanyahu's strong ties to the Zionist and Christian right in this country. But if the next president is not able to act, it will be the end of a two-state solution. We will see anarchy and violence that will again and again spill out beyond the borders of Israel and Palestine. And the longer Israel's occupation continues, the larger the number of Palestinians who will start to call for equal rights. And thus, they will push the question of how it is possible for Israel to be both Jewish and democratic to the center of the debate. And they will begin to undermine the very foundations on the basis of which Israel was created. Thank you.